Okay, so today we're going deep on a case that's really important, I think, for anyone who's studying maritime law, especially looking at personal injury stuff, and it really kind of gets to the heart of some pretty complex issues about how federal maritime law and state law interact. And it also really gets into how we think about responsibility when someone gets hurt. So we're talking about the case of Pope and Talbot, Inc. v. Hahn, a 1953 Supreme Court decision. And I think this is one of those cases that, it might seem like, oh, it's just another old case on the books, but the repercussions of this decision are still felt today.
Absolutely, it's definitely a landmark case.
Yeah, so for our listeners, the law students out there who are maybe just starting to wrap their heads around maritime law. This is a must-know case. And I guess to kind of kick things off, the fundamental question at the heart of this whole thing is like, when you have someone who gets injured on a ship, but they're not a seaman, they're not part of a crew, there may be a shore-based worker who's temporarily on board, whose laws apply. Like, is it federal maritime law, or do the state laws where the ship happens to be docked, do those laws govern the situation?
Yeah, that's really the central conflict here, the interplay between these two bodies of law. And to see why this is so important, we have to really get into the specifics of what happened.
Right. Okay, so let's break it down. We have Charles Hahn, who was a carpenter working for this company called Hames Ship Sealing. And he was doing some work on a ship owned by Pope and Talbot. The ship was docked in Pennsylvania, and Hahn was there to basically get some equipment ready for loading grain.
So pretty standard maritime operation.
Exactly, yeah. But here's where things go wrong. Hahn ends up falling through an open hatch on the ship and gets injured, pretty seriously injured. So naturally, he sues Pope and Talbot, the ship owners, claiming, first of all, that the ship was unseaworthy.
And for our listeners, unseaworthy doesn't just mean the ship was literally going to sink. It's a legal term.
Yeah, good point. It means the ship wasn't reasonably safe for its intended use. Basically, it means that there was some condition on the ship that made it dangerous for the people working on it.
Exactly. It's about the ship owner's duty to provide a reasonably safe working environment.
Right, and that's a pretty crucial concept in maritime law. So Hahn is arguing that that duty was breached. And then on top of that, he's also claiming that Pope and Talbot was negligent in how they maintained the ship.
So you have these two key arguments, unseaworthiness and negligence.
Right, and those are going to come up again and again as we go through this. So the case goes to trial, and the jury comes back with some pretty interesting findings. They agree with Hahn. They find that the ship was unseaworthy, that Pope and Talbot was negligent, but then they also say that Hahn himself was partially responsible for his injuries. They attribute about 17.5% of the blame to him. This is where the concept of contributory negligence comes into play.
And contributory negligence used to be a really strict rule. Basically, if you were even slightly at fault, like 1% your fault, you couldn't recover anything at all.
Yeah, talk about harsh. So the jury initially awards Hahn $36,000 in damages, but because of this contributory negligence thing, the trial court reduces the award. And they also try to get Hen, Hahn's employer, to pay part of the damages.
So things are already getting complicated. You've got the ship owner, the worker's employer, and the worker himself all potentially liable in different ways.
Right, a real legal tangle. But wait, there's more. The case gets appealed, and the Court of Appeals throws another wrench into the gears. They agree that Hahn deserves to get something from Pope and Talbot, but they completely overturn the decision that Hahn, the employer, should have to contribute.
So now there's this disagreement between different levels of the court system on these key issues. Should Hahn be penalized at all for being partially at fault? And should his employer be on the hook for part of the damages? And that's what sends this case all the way up to the Supreme Court.
Right, the Supreme Court steps in to settle these big legal questions. And I think before we get into what the Supreme Court actually decided, it's really important to highlight one key fact that kind of hangs over this whole case. Hahn, the guy who got hurt, he wasn't a traditional seaman. He was a carpenter who rarely worked on shore. But the work he was doing on the ship, preparing the equipment for grain loading, that was work that typically would have been done by seamen.
Yeah, that's a really crucial distinction, and it gets to the heart of some of the legal arguments. Like, does the fact that Hahn was doing something traditionally done by seamen give him the same rights and protections as a seaman, even though he wasn't technically part of the crew?
Exactly. And that's something the Supreme Court was going to have to grapple with. So, okay, let's dive into the Supreme Court's decision. They had three main issues to figure out. First, should Pennsylvania's law on contributory negligence, which would have completely barred Hahn from getting anything because he was partly at fault, should that rule trump the principles of maritime law, which, as we said, usually just reduce the damages?
That's the first big question, federal law versus state law. Then second, there was the issue of the payments Hahn was getting from his employer, Hain, under the Longshoremen's Act. You know, should those payments be subtracted from what Pope and Talbot would have to pay?
Right, because the Longshoremen's Act is a whole separate system for compensating workers who get hurt on the job in maritime settings.
Exactly, and it's designed to provide some level of protection for these workers, but it's a separate system from the traditional tort system where you sue someone for negligence.
So the court had to figure out how these two systems interacted. And then the third issue was all about the seaworthiness doctrine. You know, we talked about how Hahn argued the ship was unseaworthy. Well, there was a previous Supreme Court case, Seas Shipping Co. v. Siraki, where the court said that stevedores, who are also shore-based workers involved in loading and unloading cargo, they were covered by the seaworthiness doctrine. So the question in Hahn was, should they stick with that precedent, or should they narrow it and say it doesn't apply to someone like Hahn, a carpenter doing prep work?
Yeah, that's a really important point. Siraki kind of expanded the scope of who could claim unseaworthiness, and the court in Hahn had to decide whether to keep that expansion or pull back.
Okay, so three big questions. Federal versus state law, Longshoremen's Act payments, and the scope of seaworthiness. What did the Supreme Court say?
Well, they gave pretty clear answers. First, they said the federal maritime law wins. So Pennsylvania's law on contributory negligence, the one that says any fault bars recovery, that didn't apply. Hahn was still entitled to damages, just reduced to account for his share of the blame.
Okay, so a win for Hahn on that one, and a clear statement that in these maritime cases, federal law usually has the final say. What about the Longshoremen's Act payments?
The court said, nope, those payments don't reduce what Polk and Talbot has to pay. Their reasoning was basically that the Longshoremen's Act is supposed to be this no-fault system. You know, the employer pays benefits to the injured worker, regardless of who's at fault. And the court said that letting a shipowner off the hook because the worker is getting those benefits, that would totally undermine the whole purpose of the Longshoremen's Act.
Right. It would kind of create a loophole where shipowners could potentially avoid responsibility for their own negligence or for having an unsafe ship.
Exactly. The court wanted to keep those systems separate.
Makes sense. And then what about Siraki and the seaworthiness doctrine? Did they overrule it or?
Nope, they actually doubled down on Siraki. They said, yes, the duty to provide a seaworthy vessel that applies not just to the crew, but also to other workers who are doing tasks that are traditionally performed by seamen, even if they're not officially part of the crew.
Okay, so they're really broadening the scope of who's protected by this doctrine, and they're specifically linking it to the type of work being done, not just the worker's job title.
Right, so in Hahn's case, even though he was a carpenter, the work he was doing, preparing the ship for loading, that was work that seamen would normally do, so he deserved the same protection.
So that's a big win for maritime workers in general. It's saying that even if you're not a seaman, if you're doing seaman's work, you have the right to expect a safe and seaworthy vessel.
Exactly. And I think that's a really important takeaway for our listeners, especially those who are interested in advocating for workers' rights. This case really expanded the legal protections for a whole category of workers who were previously kind of in a gray area.
Okay, so we know what the Supreme Court decided. Federal law trumps state law, longshoremen's payments don't reduce shipowner liability, and the seaworthiness doctrine covers a broad range of workers. Now let's get into the why. Like, what was the court's reasoning behind these decisions?
All right, so let's start with the federal versus state law issue. The court's main point here was that there needs to be uniformity in maritime law. You can't have different rules in different states because that would create chaos, especially when you're dealing with, you know, ships that travel from port to port, from state to state.
Right. Imagine the confusion if a ship owner had to follow Pennsylvania's rules on contributory negligence while in Pennsylvania waters, but then switch to New York's rules as soon as they cross state lines.
Exactly. It would be a nightmare. And the court said that this need for uniformity comes straight from the Constitution, which gives the federal government power over maritime matters. They even specifically mentioned the case of Erie Railroad Co. v. Tompkins, which is a really famous case about federal courts applying state law in certain situations. But they said that Erie doesn't apply here because the concept of a seaworthy vessel, that's a federal maritime right, not just some random state law tort.
Okay, so that's a pretty powerful statement about the supremacy of federal law in this area. And what about the contributory negligence thing? Like, why did they stick with the maritime rule of comparative negligence instead of Pennsylvania's stricter rule?
Well, they basically said that the old common law rule of contributory negligence, the all-or-nothing rule, was too harsh, too unfair. They said it didn't fit with the goals of admiralty law, which is supposed to be about fairness and providing remedies for those who are injured in maritime activities.
So they favored the more balanced approach of comparative negligence, where you apportion blame and reduce damages accordingly.
Right, that's the maritime way.
Okay, so that explains the federal versus state law and the contributory negligence stuff. What about the expansion of the seaworthiness doctrine? Like, how did they connect Hahn, a carpenter, to the stevedores in the Siraki case?
It's all about the function, the role of the worker, not their job title. Just like the stevedores in Siraki were crucial for loading and unloading cargo, Hahn's work preparing the grain loading equipment, that was essential for the ship to fulfill its purpose, which is to transport goods by sea.
So even though he wasn't a traditional sailor, he was doing work that was vital to the ship's operation.
Right, and the court said that those workers, even if they're land-based most of the time, they face the same dangers as seamen when they're on board, and they're just as reliant on the ship being seaworthy. So the shipowner's duty should extend to them too.
Okay, that makes sense. But, you know, not everyone agreed with this reasoning. Justice Jackson had a pretty strong dissent. What were his main objections?
Justice Jackson was really concerned about federal overreach. He thought that the court was basically stepping on the toes of the states by saying that federal law completely wipes out state tort law in these cases. He especially didn't like it in this case because Hahn was a shore-based worker who got hurt in Pennsylvania waters.
So he thought there should be more room for state law to play a role, especially when you're dealing with workers who aren't traditional seamen.
Exactly. And he also argued that Congress, when they created the Longshoremen's Act, they intended to create a distinction between seamen and harbor workers. He thought the court was blurring that distinction by extending the seaworthiness doctrine to someone like Hahn.
So he was worried about upsetting the balance that Congress had tried to strike?
Right. He saw it as a federalism issue.
Okay. And then there was Justice Frankfurter, who wrote a concurrence. Did he agree with the majority, or did he side with Justice Jackson?
He actually agreed with the majority on the outcome, you know, that Hahn should be covered by the seaworthiness doctrine. But he had this really interesting point of caution. He was worried that by expanding the seaworthiness doctrine to cover longshoremen and other harbor workers, the court might be unintentionally weakening their right to sue for negligence.
So he was saying that there's this potential tension between the unseaworthiness claim and the negligence claim, and he was worried that by strengthening one, the court might be weakening the other.
Exactly. He saw it as a complex question that the court hadn't fully resolved, and he was basically flagging it for future courts to grapple with.
So even though he agreed with the result in this case, he was highlighting a potential problem down the line.
Yeah, and I think it's a good lesson for any law student. You always have to think about the potential unintended consequences of a legal decision. Even a decision that seems like a clear victory for one side can have ripple effects in other areas of the law.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground. What are the big, big takeaways from Pope and Talbot v. Hahn that our listeners should remember?
All right, I think there are three big ones. First, federal maritime law, it's supreme in maritime tort cases. State law can't contradict it. Second, the duty to provide a seaworthy vessel that goes beyond just the crew. It covers anyone doing work traditionally done by seamen, even if they're not technically part of the ship's company. And third, the Longshoremen's Act. It doesn't shield third parties like ship owners from liability.
Okay, so three key principles that have had a huge impact on maritime law. And for those of you studying law, this case really shows you how the courts balance competing interests, like the need for uniformity in maritime law versus the state's rights to govern their own affairs. And it shows how legal doctrines can evolve over time to adapt to new situations.
Absolutely. And as Justice Frankfurter pointed out, even landmark decisions can leave open questions that future courts will have to wrestle with.
So Pope and Talbot v. Hahn, it's not just some dry legal case from the past. It's a living, breathing part of the legal landscape that still shapes how we think about maritime injuries and who's responsible when something goes wrong.
And with that, we come to the end of our deep dive.
But before we go, I want to leave our listeners with something to ponder, especially building on what Justice Frankfurter said about the potential conflict between seaworthiness and negligence claims. As the duty to provide a seaworthy ship extends further and further to cover workers who aren't traditional seamen, what does this mean for the future of negligence lawsuits in this area? Are those two types of claims going to stay distinct, or are they going to start to merge? And how will that affect the rights of maritime workers and the responsibilities of ship owners?
It's a really thought-provoking question, you know, one that goes straight to the heart of how we think about justice and fairness in the maritime world. And I think it's a question that's only going to become more important as technology changes the nature of maritime work and the types of workers who are involved.
So keep that in mind as you continue your legal studies. And who knows, maybe one of you listening will be the lawyer who argues the next big case that redefines the boundaries of seaworthiness and negligence in maritime law.
Until next time, keep exploring the fascinating world of legal precedent.